Radio Prague News. Czech pharmacists are considering going on strike on Wednesday. Finance Minister Bohuslav Sobotka has said that he does not plan any significant reduction in taxes, and former Communist Party chairman Miroslav Grebeníček is going to lead the party's list of candidates in South Moravia in June's parliamentary elections. The head of the Czech Chamber of Pharmacists, Lubomír Chudoba, has said that the planned strike of pharmacists is becoming inevitable because of the attitude of the health ministry. Mr. Chudoba said that the outcome of a meeting of pharmacists and Health Minister David Rath on Monday will decide whether pharmacies will close their doors on Wednesday or not. Czech pharmacists disagree with the ministry's recent decision to cut their profit margins by 3% in order to reduce medicine costs. Meanwhile, Health Minister David Rath says he's considering a further reduction of the profit margin, which now stands at 29%. The Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Bohuslav Sobotka has said that he's not considering any significant reduction in the overall tax burden in the coming 4 to 5 years. Mr. Sobotka said, however, that he plans to restructure the taxes. Speaking in a televised debate on Sunday, Minister Sobotka said that the overall tax rate should stabilize around 37% in the coming years. The former chairman of the opposition Communist Party, Miroslav Grebeníček, is going to lead the Communist candidate list in South Moravia in June's parliamentary elections. Mr. Grebeníček will compete in his constituency with Finance Minister Bohuslav Sobotka of the ruling Social Democrats, Environment Minister Libor Ambrozek of the Coalition Christian Democrats, and Václav Mencl, an MP for the opposition Civic Democrats. Mr. Grebeníček, who is seen as a hardliner, stepped down last autumn after 12 years of being party leader. The Communists are the third strongest party, according to public opinion polls. They occupy one-fifth of the seats in the lower house. Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has said that he supports Health Minister David Rath's information campaign in the form of paid newspaper advertisements. Mr. Paroubek called it the only way to put right facts concerning the activity of the healthcare sector. Advertisements featuring Minister Rath's portrait have appeared in Czech papers this week, promising to ensure more healthcare and medicines for Czechs in 2006. The ministry claims in the advertisements that it motivates physicians to prescribe cheaper generic drugs in higher quantity. The chairman of the Coalition Christian Democrats, Miroslav Kalousek, has called the advertisements unethical. And finally, the weather. The beginning of next week should be overcast in most parts of the country. Daytime temperatures should range from -2 to 0 degrees Celsius. I'm Pavla Horáková, that's the news.
Your station is Radio Prague, and I'm Ian Willoughby. Thanks very much for joining us. Today, the answer to our latest competition, revealed in Mailbox. Pavla Horáková has a letter from Prague on gaming bars in the Czech Republic. And later in Czech Books, we meet Jerry Turner, one of the leading translators of Czech literature into English. But first, I'm joined by Pavla Horáková with Mailbox.
Hello and welcome to the first Mailbox in 2006. Happy New Year to everyone, and we hope you will continue listening to Radio Prague and sending us your reception reports, questions and comments. And let's get straight to last month's competition question. We asked you to tell us the name of a wildlife conservationist and author who won wide recognition for her observations on animal behavior in Africa. She was born in the northeastern town of Opava. She went to Kenya at the age of 27, where she worked and lived until her death in 1980. Coincidentally, earlier this week, it was exactly 25 years since her death, and January the 20th will be the 95th anniversary of our mystery lady's birth. And she's not Jane Goodall or Mrs. Amatucci, as some of you have guessed. So let's now hear some of the correct entries. This one is from Theodor Shepetitsky from Canada.
Your mystery lady is Joy Adamson, whose name at birth was Friederike Victoria Gessner. Her name, as Joy Adamson, author of Born Free, comes from her third husband, George Adamson. Prior to this, she had been married to Austrian Victor von Carville and Swiss botanist Peter Bali.
Some listeners wondered why some documents say that she was born in Troppau, Austria, and others mention Opava. Well, Troppau is the German name of the Silesian town of Opava. Many towns in the border regions have both Czech and German names. And this answer came from Tony Prescott from Australia.
The naturalist described in your competition is Joy Adamson. Because she was born under the old empire, references describe her as Austrian, just like Freud or Mahler and Porsche, who are described as German. Seems you Czechs have trouble holding on to your own.
And Mary Lou Krennick from Texas wanted to share this personal experience.
Born Free became a popular book, movie and song in the 1960s. I sang the song at one of my high school graduation ceremonies, and the lyrics and music remain dear to my heart to this day. We all want to have that sense of being free.
Also from the United States, Todd A. Berry writes,
"The making of the motion picture Born Free inspired the actors in the movie, Virginia McKenna and Bill Travers, who played Joy and George Adamson, to establish the Born Free Foundation. Thanks for bringing back a happy memory of an endearing and enduring movie."
And Annette Harris, who follows Radio Prague in Canada, wrote this.
Joy Adamson wrote three books about Elsa and her life in Kenya: Born Free, Living Free, and Forever Free. She was killed by a former employee on January the 3rd, 1980.
And John Shepherd from England has sent us more detail.
Her dead body was discovered on the 3rd of January 1980, and at first it was thought she had been killed by lions, but later it was concluded that she had been murdered, possibly by poachers, but probably by a former employee who made an admission of guilt and was convicted of the crime. George Adamson was also himself fatally shot by poachers in 1989.
Ian Juniper follows Radio Prague in Australia and has some more information about Joy Adamson's background.
Joy Adamson was born in 1910 to Victor Gessner and Trauta, whose maiden name was Greipel. Her father, Victor, was a civil servant with qualifications as an architect or engineer. This information comes from The Great Safari, The Lives of George and Joy Adamson by Adrian House, published by William Morrow and Company in 1993. I must confess that I had to look it up in one of my daughter Elizabeth's books. She's mad about animals, convicts and explorers.
Thank you very much for all those answers and the time you took researching. But as usual, only one of you can win, I'm afraid. And this time the lucky one is Gautam Kumar Sharma from India. Congratulations, and your prize is in the post. And of course, our competition continues with a new question for January, maybe a little more challenging than the previous one. The sugar cube is something that everybody is familiar with, but what do we know about its origin? This month, we would like to know who, when, and where first invented the sugar cube. The address for your answers is, as usual, Radio Prague 12099 Prague, the Czech Republic, or English at radio.cz. And now let's hear the title song from the film Born Free, written by John Barry and sung by Matt Munro.
Born free, as free as the wind blows, as free as the grass grows, born free to follow your heart. Live free, and beauty surrounds you. The world still astounds you. Each time you look at a star,
what a great piece of music. I must say, I was also an avid fan of Born Free in my childhood. And from your letters, we turn now to Letter from Prague, also with Pavla Horakova.
In the summer of 2004, an explosion ripped through a busy shopping thoroughfare in the centre of Prague. The blast took place outside a casino and was a failed attempt to kill the casino's owner. News of the explosion, which injured some 20 people, including foreign tourists, made headlines around the world. In the days and weeks after the blast, the Czech media were discussing the connection of gambling, money laundering and organized crime in the Czech Republic. Everybody seemed to agree, including state-level and local officials, that the number of casinos and slot machine bars should be reduced and definitely no new ones should be opened. There are over 60 such establishments in the historic center of Prague alone. In the aftermath of the explosion, the mayor himself promised Prague citizens that the number of gambling clubs and bars with slot machines will be reduced. At the end of 2004, the Christian Democrats in Prague called on the City Hall and the Prague Transport Authority, owned by the city, to remove slot machines from metro stations and stop signing new leases. The promises and calls were welcomed by Prague citizens. But as usual, there's a catch. In 2004, Czechs spent 85 billion crowns on betting and gambling, and the industry employs 50,000 people. Individual Prague districts collect some 140 million crowns a year from gambling clubs. The transport authority makes 8 million by renting its property to bars with slot machines. Regarding casinos, which are subject to different regulations, the authorities said after the blast that their hands were tied until a new lottery law was passed. The amendment was indeed submitted to the lower house 6 months ago. But according to Deputy Finance Minister Tomáš Prouza, its passing is being delayed by interest groups that lobby opposition MPs. Originally expected to come into force last Sunday, the law is unlikely to be passed before the June election, Mr. Prouza says. In the immediate surroundings of the Czech radio building on Vinohradská Street, there are three gambling bars. After the incident almost 2 years ago, I thought they might soon disappear, especially because they look a disgrace with their garish neon lights right next to a public service institution. It did not happen. Recently, a clothes shop closed down one block up from the radio building. Curious to see what's going to replace it, I read the construction permit displayed in the window. It says that the Prague 2 municipality has approved its reconstruction into a gambling bar. And, directly across the street from the listed Czech radio building, a large street-level space is undergoing renovation. You can't see inside, and the etched glass signs are still covered with black paper. One of the sheets came off the other day. It read, Casino.
This is Radio Prague, and we hope you're having a very pleasant weekend. Now it's time for me to put you in the very capable hands of David Vaughan, who joins us for Czech Books. David's guest is Jerry Turner, one of the leading translators of Czech literature into English.
A very warm welcome back to another edition of Czech Books. And today I'm joined by a man who's translated many Czech writers into English. And if you're interested in Czech literature, you may well have come across his name in connection with works by Ivan Klíma or Václav Havel or Ludvík Vaculík and many other Czech writers. He's Jerry Turner. Welcome to the studio, Jerry.
Thank you.
You've been translating for many years. How did you start in the business?
I started in the business of translation, or rather as a translator full-time, when I came to work in Prague in 1971 as a translator from French for the World Federation of Trade Unions. But as a freelance translator, that dates from 1977 or 8, when I first translated songs and poems by underground Czech writers.
And it must have been a pretty amazing time to be in Prague. I mean, it was a very bleak time in a sense, wasn't it? In that it was a time when, just after the Soviet invasion, when so-called normalization was taking place. But you managed actually to get to know quite a lot of people in dissident circles at the time, didn't you?
Yes. Thanks to pub culture, I was soon sucked into a group of people around one particular pub in the old town, where the locals consisted of painters, sculptors, and people from the university, people who were no longer allowed to teach. It was quite a ferment, although it was a time of a bad hangover, was what it felt like most of all.
Let's hear a short extract from one of your translations, and you say that this is going to be from the very first book that you translated.
Yes, by this time I was back in England, and in around 1981 or two, the first book I translated was by the Moravian philosopher Milan Šumečka, who lived a great deal of his life in Bratislava in Slovakia, where he lectured in Slovak and wrote in Slovak, but also in Czech. And one of the books that he wrote in Czech was an analysis of the what he called the restoration of order. In other words, the reinstitution of a Stalinist-type regime after the Soviet invasion of 1968. It was after 1968 that he was dismissed from his university post and went and worked as a bulldozer driver and went on writing, as a result of which he did suffer persecution from the state police. And in this book, he recounts the mentality of the state police. Much has been written about the interrogations of the 1970s, and there will no doubt still be more descriptions as they continue. The methods are many, and the interrogators differ greatly. Apart from regional variations, the charges also differ, and so, of course, to those under interrogation. When I read Ludwig Vaculík's A Cup of Coffee with My Interrogator, I said to myself that nobody could describe it better. It is a perfect description. That special combination of formally correct behavior, cunning, stupidity, lies, trickery, and a unique kind of intimacy. The latter derives from the fact that they know all there is to know about you. They know all about your wife, your children, your relatives, and your friends. They have read your books and manuscripts and your private correspondence. You can imagine them, listeners, and how they must have picked up every little sigh. For years you thought that nobody could care less about your problems and opinions. Fear not, they care. They may be uneducated, but in the course of their years of investigating selected representatives of the Czechoslovak intelligentsia, they have picked up a thing or two. They're able to appreciate the latest Samizdat novel, for example. Nonetheless, their sole aim is to write an exhaustive report, to detect a promising clue to a criminal activity, to discover about as so far unknown contact, or even, maybe, what they describe as a channel. They constantly threaten you and try to put the wind up you because, as they repeat ad nauseam, their chief objective is not to punish crime, but to prevent it. Thus, every hearing ends with the reproof, "Why do you do it? Can't you see it's senseless? You're just hurting yourself and your family. You've got a flat and a car. You're not hungry. What else do you want? We'll manage to build socialism without writers, journalists, and philosophers. Just get what you can out of it, like everyone else, and we'll leave you alone." And so it goes on, hour after hour.
I mean, this is the world where the surreal has become the real, isn't it? And there's this extraordinary sort of cat-and-mouse game, both sort of literally and psychologically. And that sort of atmosphere really does permeate a lot of writing at the time, doesn't it?
Well, indeed. Listeners to Radio Prague not long ago had the chance to hear a play by Václav Havel on exactly the theme which Šumečka was dealing with there.
And in that particular production of the play, you, in fact, played Vavák, the playwright, didn't you, who's visited by this menacing figure?
Yes. If listeners want to go back and listen to that episode, if it's still on the website, they will certainly pick up the things that Šumečka is saying about the interrogator, as he is obviously in the play, how he knows everything about the writer.
You mentioned that you translated Milan Šumečka when you had already left Czechoslovakia. You were in Britain in the early 1980s. What else were you doing at the time? Because there was a lot of dissident writing, somehow or other, getting its way out of Czechoslovakia that couldn't be published back home, wasn't there? Were you involved in this whole process of getting it translated?
Yes, I was approached by Willem Prečan, who had set up the Documentation Centre for the Promotion of Independent Czechoslovak Literature in West Germany, as it was then. And he was bringing out very interesting analyses of the free intellectual activity in this country at that time. Beneath the drear exterior, there were very lively things going on in intellectual life and in literary life in this country, although the major writers couldn't be published. It meant that I was also asked by Prečan from time to time to translate shorter pieces, feuilletons by Vatsulik by Havel, and short stories times by other band writers like Karol Petska. So I was becoming more cognizant of the literary scene, which I knew very little of before. In fact, I left Czechoslovakia in 1980.
And so let's hear something you were translating at the time. You have one of the publications here from the time that was published in English by the Documentation for the Promotion of Independent Czechoslovak Literature. So let's hear something.
Here's a piece by Václav Havel, written on the 1st of December 1988, so that's a year before the revolution, and it was when they issued, for the first time, the opposition issued a very clear statement of demands in terms of civil liberties and questioning the leading role of the Communist Party. It was called the Movement for Civil Liberties, or HOS, and the manifesto was called Democracy for All. What is to gain the upper hand in the immediate future? Havel says, the awakening spirit of freedom, common sense and civic awareness, or the water cannon. It could well be the water cannon, of course, but its domination will certainly not last forever. Soaking people to the skin and scaring them is one thing. Eliminating civil discontent is another. Water cannon are more likely to intensify the latter rather than eliminate it. Above all, there is no way now they will avert the logical consequences of the present political and economic events. So we should enter the new year without any illusions, but also with the assurance that the prison warder who talked to me in my cell on 28th October was not wrong when he said, you've got truth on your side.
That's fascinating, isn't it? Coming just a year before the fall of communism, written in December 1988. He was pretty much right, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, and maybe he didn't even dare believe that it was as imminent, but it is interesting that we're reading it now, and we're in a similar time of the year as to when that was written. It seems such a long time ago now, doesn't it, 1988?
Let's just finish by looking at another of your translations. This time it's a work that has nothing to do with the communist era. It goes back to a period slightly before that of the Nazi occupation of the Czech lands of Czechoslovakia, which is in another book that you translated, a compilation that you translated for your friend Paul Wilson, I believe.
Well, I didn't do all the translations in it, but I did three of them, and one of them is by František Langer, who was quite a character, certainly in pre-war Czechoslovakia, a soldier, a doctor, and a great writer. This is a charming story, which I recommend all your listeners, known as the Sword of St. Wenceslas, and about a legend about how the Sword of St. Wenceslas will be found, is hidden somewhere, and when the nation is at its slowest ebb, will be brought forth and bring out the knights from the hill of Blanik to save the nation. And here he sets the scene for the story. It was in 1939 when, as you know, Hitler's Germans, soldiers, policemen and cutthroats occupied our lands, murdering, jailing and plundering us, and taking away our rights and freedoms, and along with them our memory of the past and our hope for the future, not to mention our language, the very breath of the nation. It was a time of despair and desolation, and we lived in terror of the future. Then, during the first Christmas of those dark days, something happened that changed the way the legend will be told in the future. So listen, children, this concerns you. At that time, the Christmas season brought the unhappy people some consolation and strength, for they were able to get together more easily than at other times. For what could have been more welcome than to feel a true Czech heart beating close to your own? And so the churches of Prague were full for the Christmas midnight mass that year. The fullest of all, packed to the doors, was the Grand Cathedral of St. Vitus. People thronged in from every corner of Prague, but unlike other years, the parents, as if in collusion with each other, brought their older children along with them. They had not conspired to do so. They were simply all driven by the same idea. What if the Germans ban our ancient midnight ceremony next year? They've banned everything else we're proud of, everything that sustains us. The midnight mass at St. Vitus is held over the tombs of our kings, and we sing our own hymns. The beauty and the history of the place, and the sanctity of the moment, will awaken proud thoughts of our past, and strengthen our belief in a future rebirth. The very thoughts our conquerors wish to extinguish from our hearts and minds. Let us take our children with us, and if this is to be the last time, they will have something to remember all of their days.
And how does that story develop and end?
The story continues with some Czech children, finding the sword as they're playing on the island of Kampa in the snow, and they spirit the sword away somehow right under the nose of the German guards leaning over Charles Bridge, and they hide it. Perhaps under somebody's got it under his coat. Nobody knows exactly where it is. Since then, says Langer, the miraculous sword is in hiding again, and no one knows where it is. All we know is that Czech children will have taken it into their care, and that it is safe with them, and will reappear when the right moment comes. That's why the legend of the miraculous sword in the Charles Bridge will now have to be told in a different way. It is no longer hidden beneath a stone. No longer will we walk across the bridge and say, somewhere here lies our hope and our salvation when things are their worst. But whenever we meet a Czech child, we will say, this is where it is. And there it will remain hidden until the time is ripe. Then St. Wenceslas will ride out at the head of the Knights of Blanik to save us. But when he gets to the Charles Bridge, his horse won't stumble against legendary stone. Instead, a child will run out, pull the sword up from out under his or her coat, and give it to him. The age-old prophecy will come true, and the Czech lands and all their peoples will enjoy peace and tranquility forever and ever. And that was written in 1940.
Well, Jerry, there are so many other things we could talk about, and there are so many things that you've translated, but I think for this time, at least, we shall leave it there. So, Jerry Turner, translator and also sometime actor, thank you very much indeed for joining us at Radio Prague.
Thank you for having me.
Ici Radio Prague, programme en langue française des émissions internationales de la radio tchèque, Onde Courte. Pour bénéficier d'une agréable réception, voici la grille de nos horaires en temps universel et fréquence en kilohertz. Sept heures vingt-sept. Europe, 5930, 7345. 8h30, 8h57. Europe, 9860, 11600. 17h30, 17h57. Europe, Afrique Centre, 5930, 15710. 19h30, 19h57. Europe, Afrique Ouest, 5930, 9430, 23h, 23h27. Amérique du Nord, 5930, 7345. Nous vous invitons à l'écoute sur le web. Pour cela, veuillez vous connecter au site www.radio.cz/français. Radio Prague est aussi sur le satellite. Vous trouverez toutes les informations sur notre site www.radio.cz/français.